from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's forum, the deadline to come up with a deal to avoid sequestration has come and gone. President Obama made some dire predictions about the March 1st deadline. So what political and economic fallout are we actually dealing with? And now that Chuck Hagel's rocky confirmation as defense secretary is over, will John Brennan, Obama's pick for CIA director, get the same treatment? Plus, three new cabinet appointments were announced. We'll take a look at the big political stories with a team of Washington experts. Join us for this morning's forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. This forum hour, we want to survey recent political events in the nation's capital and consider both short and long-term effects economically and politically of the passing of the deadline to avoid sequestration, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, the Supreme Court and voting rights, and the confirmation hearings of Senator Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense, as well as the upcoming hearings on John Brennan as selection of President Obama for the nation's next director of the CIA, and three recently announced new cabinet posts. So lots to cover, and joining us for the hour are certainly a distinguished trio to help us cover all of this. Mark Sandlow is with us from Washington, Associate Academic Director with the University of California's Washington Center, and now Washington Editor of the California News Service. Welcome, Mark.
Morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Julie Hirschfeld-Davis, who is Congressional and Politics Reporter for Bloomberg News. Welcome, Julie Hirschfeld-Davis.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And also good morning to Todd Zwillick, who joins us from Washington, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC. Welcome, Todd Zwillick.
Hi, Michael. Good to talk to you again.
And likewise here. And let's begin with you and just find out what the buzz is here on the new nominations. We're talking about Energy Department, EPA, and Budget Director. And we heard the announcement earlier this morning on NPR, and the analysis seemed to suggest that there may be an uphill battle. And I'd like to get your take on what kind of uphill battle we're going to face where Brennan is concerned, but also on the EPA because of climate change.
Because of climate change, I think the highest profile nominee probably in the group this morning that was announced at the White House is Sylvia Matthews-Burwell. She is currently, or until recently, was in charge of the Walmart Philanthropic Foundation, the sort of charity wing of the Walmart empire. Former budget official in the Clinton administration. She's going to have a very high-profile job because, as everybody who hasn't been under a rock knows, there are major budget fights still going on between the White House and the Republicans in Congress. This recent sequestration battle was only a blip, I'm sorry to say, in a much longer and more protracted battle. There is a formal budget fight coming this spring and summer on Capitol Hill. Around here, we call it regular order, but that doesn't matter to you. What that means is the House and Senate are actually going to debate budgets. The White House will be intimately involved. She will be OMB director. That means White House budget director. And she's going to be Obama's point person on this next round of about $2 trillion in budget cuts that everybody says they want to try to get to. That's called the grand bargain. That's what could fix sequestration. That's what could fix entitlements. That's what could get an agreement on tax rates and loopholes, maybe. And she's going to be a face that a lot of Americans probably would be seeing more of than your average budget director, I think, coming up.
Well, I want to get into sequestration more and the effects that are likely to come down, but Julie Hirschfeld-Davis, I mentioned climate change and with respect to the new appointment of Gina McCarthy as the head of the EPA, because she has, replacing Lisa Jackson, she has some pretty strong sentiments, at least, that she's expressed publicly on climate change.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, what Todd is referring to, which is the case with Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, I think will also be the case with Gina McCarthy, which is that her confirmation fight on Capitol Hill is really likely to be more of a proxy fight for policy. We're not just going to be talking about Gina McCarthy, the person, and is she qualified, which I think many people on both sides of the aisle would say she is qualified. It's more about her beliefs and the fact that because there is not a bipartisan majority in Congress for getting President Obama's climate change agenda enacted, that he has basically made it known that he's going to try to do that through the environment Environmental Protection Agency and through the regulatory process. And so she is kind of the poster child for that strategy and is going to be harshly questioned about her very clear view that you can use the regulatory process, and you should, to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and to do through agencies what Congress has really been unwilling to do. So I think we're going to hear a lot of harsh questioning of her and of the administration's intention to do that and implement that strategy throughout her confirmation process. I wouldn't think that she is going to be denied confirmation over it, but it's certainly going to be a forum for Republicans to express their opposition to this approach, and it could get kind of to be a nasty fight. Not as high profile, I agree with Todd, as Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, but certainly a close second.
Well, there was a nasty fight over the Chuck Hagel nomination, Mark Santolo, and likely to be over John Brennan too, no?
Yeah, because Brennan, you have people on both the right and the left who are unhappy with him. And Drew is right that there's probably a proxy fight that's going to go on over the head of the new EPA. But for the head of the CIA, I mean, it's not only a proxy fight over what the Obama administration has done with its drone policy, but the guy they've nominated to be head of the CIA was somebody who's been in the center of this. I mean, somebody who knows well about the drones and has worked on the drone issue from inside the White House. And John Brennan is someone who worked very closely with the Bush White House on enhanced interrogation techniques. Most people refer to that as torture. It's very troublesome for a lot of people to see President Obama, people on the left, appointing somebody like that to be the head of the CIA. I mean, it's one thing when he names, you know, Leon Panetta, former Democratic liberal slash moderate congressman, they figure he will have some kind of oversight over this, that people could see a different kind of judgment. But there are an awful lot of folks who are very concerned about the drones. And the problem, once again, is that the Obama administration has been less than forthcoming with information. If there are enough people who on the left who are not pleased with this, all they've got to do is team up with the people on the right who are upset with anything Obama does, and that nomination could be more difficult.
And let's go back to the effects, both politically and economically, of sequestration, and the finger-pointing continues. Let's hear a cut here from President Obama and from Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
I am not a dictator. I'm the president. Yeah, I know that this has been some of the conventional wisdom that's been floating around Washington, that somehow, even though most people agree that I'm being reasonable, that most people agree I'm presenting a fair deal, the fact that they don't take it means that I should somehow, do a Jedi mind meld with these folks and convince them to do what's right.
We've known about this problem for 16 months. We've known the sequester was coming. That's why the House last year acted twice. Why didn't the Senate Democrats act? Where was the president's plan? Why didn't they pass something?
That was, Speaker of the House Boehner speaking yesterday on Meet the Press. And Todd Zwillick, I mean, notwithstanding so much commentary about the partisanship and the finger-pointing, I mean, the fact of the matter is, post-sequester here, as you mentioned, we're facing another big uphill budget battle, and the blaming continues, and so does, the predictions. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office is going to be, at least according to them, this is all going to stifle economic growth and slow down the stock market, but it's also going to mean a continued bleeding of jobs.
It's really stunning when you look at the way Washington's been behaving when it comes to sequestration, because the way out of all these budget fights that we've been having, the real way out of it, politicians say it all the time, the way out of this is economic growth, more taxpayers earning paychecks. That's lip service, but it's all true. But sequestration, according to the CBO, as you mentioned, Mike, puts a 0.6% drag on GDP. Now, GDP is recovering so slowly at the moment that cutting off 0.6 percentage point in 2013 alone, not to mention the estimated 700,000 to 750,000 jobs, again, according to the CBO, if this $85 billion sequestration remains in effect, is really our government shooting us in the foot. And a lot of voters are really, really astounded by it. So be mad if you want to. You should be mad. Call your senator. What's the way forward on this? And nobody, I got to tell you, I'd like to be really sage on this. Nobody really knows. exactly when or if sequestration is going to get fixed. There are a couple of opportunities going forward. The first obvious one was at the end of this month when government funding runs out and we confront what's called a continuing resolution. You know, you get into government shutdown fights. It appears, according to everyone's statements, that they don't want to have a fight over sequestration when it comes to a government shutdown. Everybody's smoothing that over. So it's probably not going to get fixed then. At the top, I mentioned the big sort of formal budget battles that are coming over later in the spring and into the summer. And if there is going to be an opportunity, not only to fix this relatively small sequestration, which is only $85 billion, I know that the effects are pretty dire, as I just said, especially in a weak recovery, but it is only $85 billion. If there is an opportunity to fix that, it may be in the context of a broader deal. You've heard of a grand bargain before. Have a little bit of faith. You know, Washington may be able to get an agreement. It's not going to be easy, and it is a bit of a long shot, but it's possible. There are Republicans who are talking behind the scenes and making a couple of statements. You've heard Lindsey Graham make a statement or two saying, look, I'm a Republican who will give up $600 billion in new revenue in order to get a big deal that cuts Medicare, cuts back on Social Security, and makes a big debt reduction deal. This is the same sort of dynamic they've been talking about for years. They've done some debt reduction, but not around a grand bargain. And even a member of Congress who's up for re-election, Lindsey Graham, as a conservative, is saying that he's willing to try to find the consensus to get a deal. Can they do it? I don't know, and I don't know if anybody does know, but the effects of sequestration, this grind on the economy, politicians are all kind of standing around against the wall now with their hands in their pockets going, oh, gee, you know, who's going to get blamed for this? Are people really going to notice? Is it going to be drastic? Are they going to demand that we smooth this thing over? Or will people just get used to it and not really bug us about
it? I'm glad you're seeing light and being
sanguine. They're hoping the latter.
I'm glad you're seeing light in the possibility of a grand bargain here, Todd, because the GOP proposed budget, which I saw, is actually talking about promising no defense cuts, no tax increases, no touching retirement and plans over
Social
Security.
Yeah, that's an opening bid. Yeah. That's an opening bid, and it is troublesome when you see very ideological budgets like that. But budgets, by their very nature, are ideological documents. They are not, you know, checkbooks that you actually do the spending in. They're ideological statements of governing philosophy, and then you go from there. I'm not saying it's likely a grand bargain. I'm saying there are people making the right noises to try to get this done. The only reason I would tell you to have a tiny bit of faith, and not faith, that's a wrong word, to have a tiny bit of non-pessimism is that Washington actually has come about halfway on debt reduction. They've done a little over $2 trillion already. It doesn't seem like it, but they have. They've got a little over $2 trillion to go. The first $2 trillion was kind of the easy part. This is the hard part when you're talking about entitlements and a lot more revenue, but they have gotten some work done.
Well, again, Todd Zwillick is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International, WNYC. And Mark Sandlow, with all this finger pointing, suddenly Bob Woodward seems to be the new hero for the GOP, talking about new revenue, moving the goalposts from the perspective of what President Obama's proposing, and also suggesting that there's a lot of fear-mongering from the Obama administration, and what they want to do really is get back the House in 2 years. And he, Bob Woodward, has been threatened, supposedly.
Yeah, well, the threats were kind of silly. I actually went to high school with the goon in the Obama administration who made this threat. That's Gene Sperling. This is a guy who worked so hard during the Clinton administration that when he asked somebody if he could help set him up on a date, the guy said, gee, Gene, I just don't know many women available between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. in the morning, which is about the only time Gene was free. I think the whole idea of this sort of threat, it was a big story here in Washington.
Mark, is it a threat to say you'll regret something, especially if he's an old friend? just a caveat.
You can certainly argue, and the Obama administration certainly has a pretty bad reputation at this point in terms of its dealing with the media. In no way, as I've heard a lot of conservative talk radio folks say, was there any threats of, you know, lopping his head off. I mean, remember, Woodward's the guy who ran from the garages because he was scared that the number two guy at the FBI, Deep Throat, might, because of their conversations, his life might be in danger. I don't think there was ever that kind of threat, you could certainly read it as the Obama administration saying you may lose some of your precious access. And that would be consistent with some of the things that they have done. But in some ways, I'm not sure that one character out of the White House really tells the big story. I just want to go back quickly to something that Todd said, because it's what the way Todd described that long-term deal and the hope in Washington, it makes so much sense to so many people. The problem is it's not clear what the political rewards are for that. I mean, he's right in pointing to Lindsey Graham, and there's a guy running for re-election who actually is sticking his neck out saying, I'm a Republican, and I might agree to more revenue. But John Boehner and the people around him have suggested if he agrees to any kind of tax increases at this point, even if that just means closing loopholes, he may well be in danger of losing his speakership. The system as a whole doesn't make sense to anybody, but when you look at individual players in Washington, I mean, again, imagine for a moment that Nancy Pelosi came back to her constituents in San Francisco and said, listen, we've got a grand bargain. Here's what we've given up. We are going to make changes to Social Security. Medicare is going to have to be changed, and part of those changes are going to be fewer benefits for some people. She'd be lynched if she said that, the same way that John Boehner would be lynched if he talked about taxes. The political rewards are not set up right now to reward either side, and that's a real dangerous situation because you have Democrats right now convinced that this sequester is going to bite the Republicans when people begin to feel the effects that they could, the Democrats could take over the House in 2014, and you have Republicans who not only don't want to raise taxes, but think, as we've talked about, maybe they don't feel the cuts so much, and if people don't feel the cuts, it bolsters our argument that government needs to be trimmed. And when you have two sides, both of whom think they can win politically, there's just not much motive for them to compromise.
Well, as you talk about John Boehner not wanting to talk about taxes, he's been talking about tax a lot, saying President Obama got his tax cut. That's sort of finito. By the way, let me give out the phone number, because I know there are many of you who would like to join us, and you're invited to do so. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, your input, your involvement in the program, so join the conversation. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have directly onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Let me go back to Julie Hirschfeld-Davis. And Julie, you know, in covering Congress, and there was an article about this in The Atlantic, 113th Congress, not even half days in session. Congress before has been described as the least productive ever. They have a 3-day weekend now after the sequester. They got a 4-day weekend next week. They got a 2-week vacation that starts on March 27th. I mean, partisanship is one thing, but this doesn't seem to be necessarily a, shall we say, strong Puritan ethic work Congress, at least by many citizen standards.
Well, I think it's true. You know, if you're a normal person going to work 5 days a week, or sometimes more than 5 days a week, all day long, you look at their schedule and you kind of raise your eyebrows. I have to say, though, that this is not abnormal. I mean, this is sort of the way Congress has worked for a long time. What's really different is the level of dysfunction that's preventing them really from getting anything substantive done, even when they are here. I mean, you could ask yourself, would it really make a difference at this point if they did come 5 days a week, because the budgetary process is broken, they're not talking about what to do about sequestration, what to do in the aftermath of sequestration. I thought the whole Woodward exchange was very telling, frankly, because it indicates that both sides are much more sort of concerned at this point with laying blame and whose idea was this sequester anyway and how did it come to be, which tells you that they're not really doing anything, and as we saw, they didn't even meet until a couple hours before it took effect on Friday, to try to stave it off or to put something in its place that might be less harmful to the economy long term, that might be less harmful to job creation, that could actually do what they profess to want to do in terms of getting the long term debt under control. So I think, you know, there is a lot of rightful anger about, well, Congress is not coming, you know, not doing what they're supposed to be doing, but the process is so broken, the relationship between President Obama and this Congress is so really non-existent that it's hard to really see what could get done even if they were here. I hate to sound really cynical, but
well, they're still allegedly, at least according to every press release, planning on dealing with tax reform from both parties, with immigration and so forth. I mean, how much can they actually get done?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things that the White House was very determined to make known last week to anyone who would listen was that they felt that the process, at least around immigration, maybe not so much around the gun safety initiative, which is a more partisan It's just shaking out more on partisan lines, but that those lines of communication were still open, that they felt like there was still room to get something done there, that even with all of their the animosity that the budget process has kind of fostered, that they still thought that they could keep other things on track. And that really remains to be seen. I mean, and I think it does matter a lot what the political fallout is of these automatic across-the-board cuts. I mean, we're not seeing them right now, and I actually think that's kind of damaging to the dynamic here, because both parties are sort of sitting back with their arms crossed saying, well, you know, let's see what happens to you. No, let's see what happens to you, and trying to figure out who the public is going to blame when these things actually take effect. It's not such a big cut overall, but when you look at something like, say, unemployment benefits, when the state agencies get around to actually implementing what is, I think, a 5% cut, in the small amount of months that are left in this fiscal year to get that done, it could be an 11% cut, I heard this week, in unemployment benefits, which if you don't have a job, and in this economy a lot of people don't and really need that money, is going to really be felt. So the question is, how do constituents react? And then what do members of Congress, particularly Republicans, take away from that about what they need to do in terms of stepping up and maybe dealing with the budget problems and also dealing with the immigration issue, which is so much on the minds of the public. And we see in polling that this push that the president has made to deal with it is quite popular and actually has bipartisan support.
Well, they've reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. They did that on Thursday.
They did, and that was the third time this year that John Boehner has had to get something through his chamber with Democrats helping out and sort of throw that we're going to pass things with a majority of the majority by the wayside and just get it done. What that showed us is really that I think Republicans are feeling that, you know, you look at the polls, you look at how the public has responded to the results of the 2012 elections, and they're really worried that they're on the wrong side of a lot of social issues, including the Violence Against Women Act, including immigration, maybe even including guns. That really remains to be seen. And at the first sign of a partisan gap on that, they said, you know what, we're going to pass this through. There are enough Democrats to do it, enough like-minded Republicans to push it through. We're going to let those who want to vote no, and just get it off our plate, because it's a losing battle. And I think they feel that on a lot of these social issues. And that gives, obviously, a big opening to the White House to try to get a lot of things done that they've wanted to get done.
Well, we've heard from both sides, Todd Zwillick. I mean, essentially, Republicans are saying that President Obama is exaggerating. These cuts are not going to be all that big a deal. They're minuscule when you look at the national debt.
Well, it's really two different things that you're talking about. They are minuscule when you look at the national debt, the size of it, $16 trillion. They're even minuscule when you look at the size of debt reduction that everybody says they want to do, which is around $4 trillion, a little bit more. But when you look at it in terms of jobs in the economy in a weak recovery, it's not insignificant. We talked about a couple of the numbers at the top.
But forgive me, Todd, there are Republican leaders who are saying the effects of the sequester are going to be disastrous. So they're split even on that.
They're split even on that. Now, many of the Republicans who you hear talking about the disaster when it comes to sequestration are talking about the Defense Department because on a percentage basis, the $85 billion in cuts are split 50-50 between regular domestic discretionary spending and defense cuts. The Defense Department has already faced a round of cuts under Secretary Gates. So the defense hawks in Congress find themselves really at odds. It's an interesting dynamic. You mentioned that Republicans are split, and it's true. You're seeing a real split between two very important wings of the Republican Party. Old line defense hawks, the John McCains, the Lindsey Grahams of the world, who want to protect the Defense Department, and the new budget-cutting Tea Partiers, conservatives, not all of them Tea Party, they're at odds.
We're coming up on a break, and you can certainly join this conversation again. You're cordially invited to do so, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Toll free, 866-733-6786. Your thoughts on the aftermath of sequestration and really about all the loggerheads that we see in Washington, D.C. and what's up ahead politically as well as economically. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Twitter handle @KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The deadline has come and gone with the deal to avoid sequestration, and the president made some dire predictions about the March 1st deadline. So we're looking at the political and economic fallout that's being dealt with. And if you have some thoughts about what President Obama, if you're in support of him and what he ought to be doing as things proceed, or if you're in support of the GOP, that is the Republicans, and how they ought to proceed, or thoughts on the new appointments, which we've also covered, please let us hear them, because we'd like to know what you think. And we're talking, as I said, in general about so many things with respect to news out of Washington. This hour, our toll-free number available, 866-733-6786. Other ways to communicate with us: by email, forum@kqed.org, or on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or on our Facebook page, or you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle at @KQEDForum. Talking with Todd Zwillick from The Takeaway, Public Radio International and WNYC, and Julie Davis, congressional and politics reporter for Bloomberg News, and Mark Sandlow, who is associate academic director for the University of California's Washington Center and Washington editor of the California News Service, who also, of course, did a book on former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, San Francisco Congress representative. Mark, I want to talk a little bit about what was alluded to before by Todd Zwillick, and that is the split in the GOP. Now, the split in the GOP involves, certainly by anyone's lights, the Tea Party and the more, shall we say, conservative ring with Rand Paul, as opposed to those that perhaps Speaker Boehner is trying to lead. But things have been mixed up in some ways, too. And I just wanted to get your thoughts about this. By mixed up, I mean a couple of rising stars. We had Chris Christie, and now he seems to be, according to the New York Times and Nate Silver, not invited to CPAC. Conservatives don't love him as much as they did. The affair with Chris Christie is over, so says Nate Silver. And then you've got Marco Rubio, who gave this respondent speech to President Obama's State of the Union address, and not voting against money from Sandy. Peter King said nobody in the East should support him, whether Republican or Democrat, especially with his presidential aspirations. These are two who look like they're in decline.
This kind of split, you see lots in political parties. I mean, Democrats have certainly had it between the MoveOn.org wing of the party maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and either the Joe Lieberman or even the John Kerry wing of the party. You have people who are more the realists and those who are more the idealists. And I mean, Michael, your explanation, you leave out even more divides between them, because the Republican Party has been bolstered enormously over the last 15, 20 years, maybe even longer, with religious conservatives. George Bush monopolized their support, and it's one of the reasons he served two terms as president. And now you've got a lot of Republicans who are very worried about do we really want to be the party that stands against gay marriage? Are we really the party that wants to deprive women the choice for abortions? The problems a Republican faces, if they're not that party and they no longer can count on winning the South, they may no longer be the national party. These are very tough questions for them. It's interesting. You said that Boehner seems to be catering to the Tea Party. I think the Tea Party would perhaps say that they're concerned about just the opposite. He's torn in a number of directions, and you're right. I did this book on Pelosi, and I wanted to say, when you look back on Nancy Pelosi, one of the things that people ought to respect about her in retrospect, she held together a Democratic caucus that was every bit as divided as the Republicans are today. And remember, she had Barbara Lee and Dennis Kucinich on one end, and Heath Shuler, the pro-life, anti-gay rights congressman from North Carolina, on the other extreme. What she was able to do is to have Democrats walk in lockstep. That's not easy to do with Democrats, and the advantage of doing that is that you can force Republicans to make sloppy votes, you force Republicans to do things that they might not otherwise do, and it's one of the reasons that she became Speaker. But this then goes back to something we were talking about earlier. If you force conservative members of Congress to vote more liberally than they would otherwise, and vice versa, then suddenly you have these two polarized parties who don't seem to agree on anything. These guys right around the corner from where I am, Tom Mann at the Brookings Institution and Norm Ornstein from the American Enterprise Institute, they looked at Congress. They suggested that the United States go to the Australian model of voting, where you force everyone to vote. Not that they think it's realistic, but they had an interesting thought upon this. What their thought was is, if everyone has to vote and face a big penalty if they don't, then both parties understand that their base will be there. And no longer do you have to cater to your base to make sure they turn out at the polls. Instead, you know your base will be with you. It would force politicians to instead compete for that group in the center. That would lead to more centrist politics and more compromise. Of course, good luck trying to convince Americans who don't even want to be forced to buy, you know, health insurance that you've got to vote before you get, or you get fined. It's not realistic.
Well, the voting rights battle, which is looming and which certainly the Supreme Court has been willing to take on, gets right to the heart of this, doesn't it, in terms of the, where the parties think that their voting is going to come from?
The Democrats, you hear this constantly now, are pushing the idea, and they're outraged by it, that you know they received about, I think, it's 1.5 million more votes for House of Representative candidates this year than Republicans, and yet somehow they are in the minority. And they're in the minority because, you know, those rotten Republicans are gerrymandering. You know, and then you go back to some classic California, you know, the Phil and John Burtons of the world who – if they didn't invent, at least perfected gerrymandering for Democrats' sake. So, you know, politicians will grab the power that they can. And, you know, so part of the problem, and the Voting Rights Act fits right into this, in that there are people like John Lewis down in the Selma Bridge yesterday who had his face beat in a generation ago for standing up for basic rights. And right now there is a legitimate debate that goes on. Are voting rights acts, is the Voting Rights Act still necessary? Have we progressed as a society? This is something the Supreme Court has decided. But if you turn on the TV right now, all you hear are Democrats defending the Voting Rights Act, which, by the way, happens to benefit them, and Republicans criticizing it because, by the way, it seems to hurt them.
Well, we're going to get to your calls and emails. They're flooding in here, but I have to ask you, Julie Hirschfeld-Davis, apropos of something Todd Zwillick mentioned, do you think there's going to be a shutdown end of March?
I don't think there's going to be a shutdown. I mean, I think the one thing, as Todd mentioned, that everyone agrees on, Republican and Democrat, rank and file, maybe not so much as the leaders, but certainly for the people who are at the table trying to figure out what happens next, I think nobody wants to see a shutdown. Certainly President Obama doesn't want to see it because he's president and it's a bad thing when the government shuts down. He looks like he's unable to deal with the Congress and unable to govern effectively, which indeed he hasn't been able to on this issue for a long time. And the Republicans in Congress are worried that they would get blamed. If you look at all the polling, it's very clear that the public would see Republicans as more responsible for that, and indeed it would be because they were refusing to go along with the White House's budget demand. So I think everyone's going to try to avoid that. What we don't know, and I hate to be to pour cold water on hope of a grand bargain, but it seems like if we were going to see something along the lines of what they had been talking about for 2 years, where you take revenue and you pair it with real entitlement changes and do something big to affect the long-term debt, I think we would have seen it by now. And so in the process of getting past the expiration of the current budget authority, which expires March 27th, I don't think we're going to see anything along those lines. I think what we're going to see is a more nitty-gritty struggle over funding levels. And one thing that has happened now that sequestration is in effect, that is in Republicans' favor, is that the caps have come down. They've come down. Sequestration represents $85 billion this year, but it's $1.2 trillion over a 10-year budget window. And in imposing that and in allowing that to go into effect, the budget caps come down, so Republicans are on slightly more favorable ground, which they know, in negotiating the next set of budget levels, because right now, because previous to sequestration, those limits were higher. So they have a little bit more leverage on that. I think they're going to use it to the best of their ability.
Let's bring our callers in. And, Tom, we go to you first. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. As a voter, I find it really frustrating because I thought that we just had a grand national debate about the central issue at stake here, which is whether we ought to be slashing spending on programs that benefit people in need. And it seems to me, and seems to almost everybody else, including the Republican leadership, that the public's answer to that question was unambiguous. No, we should not be doing so. People taking unemployment benefits, for example, are not moochers or takers, as the Republican candidate characterized them. So I find it very, very frustrating that even after we've had an election that was not focused on social issues or foreign policy, it was overwhelmingly focused on this one issue, the Republicans are digging their heels in and defending a position that was soundly rejected by the American public just a few months ago. Very, very frustrating.
All right. I thank you for expressing your frustration. Want to comment, Todd Zwillick?
Well, I would just say, if you're sensing frustration between the apparent electoral mandate that President Obama and maybe Democrats got and the continuing fights over these very questions that you're seeing, keep one thing in mind, and this is hard to remember unless you sort of live in Washington and delve into the different congressional districts the way we do sometimes, unfortunately. Individual members of Congress, the vast majority of them, not all of them, the vast majority of them are safe in their districts. We just talked about gerrymandering, and we just talked about manipulations, not to voting rights, but the way congressional districts are drawn. If I'm a member of Congress from some district, I'll just say in Indiana somewhere, and my party just got thumped, and the public approval rating for Congress is 10%, do I really care if I look at my own polling back home and my district is safe and I poll at about 65? My voters back home in the district that has been tailored, drawn for me, want me to oppose President Obama. And my reelection depends on it. So you can have your guy in the White House for the next 4 years. That's fine. I'm going to keep voting the way I'm voting. And I'm also going to keep pressuring the Speaker of my party to do what he...
I think we just... lost that call.
Let me just jump in.
Yeah, Mark Sandler.
To echo that point, for Tom's sake, if you want to understand exactly what Todd was just talking about, think back to the Bay Area in 2004. In 2004, George Bush won re-election. Now, in lots of the country, that meant that for all of the untruths, for all of the manipulations, for all the problems with the war in Iraq, a majority of the American people put that commander-in-chief back in office. But you certainly weren't going to see, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Lee, George Miller, Pete Stark say anything kind about Bush after that, or certainly not support his war policy. If you want to feel slightly better about this, if the Republicans are truly on the wrong side of history on this, and there's lots of evidence they may well be, then they're going to continue to get hurt in the polls. The gerrymandering doesn't last forever. Eventually, the majority sort of burst through, so that if Republicans on a number of these issues turn out to be on the have the short straw and be representing a minority, ultimately they will lose their grip of power.
Well, I noticed this morning, Julie Hirschfeld Davis, a report that was put out, a new analysis of congressional research data by the Republican side of the Senate Budget Committee. And it shows that the amount spent on federal means-tested welfare programs, if converted to cash payments and divided among households that are below the poverty line, would actually equal a daily income greater than the median household income in 2011. They're putting out those kinds of reports. They apparently have substantiation behind them. The cash value of welfare spending, according to analysis, is $165.65 daily per household in poverty. The median household income in 2011 was $50,054 or $137.13 per day, according to analysis. It was just released on Friday.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one other thing that to echo what the caller was saying is that we have to remember that sequestration, we did have this debate during the election of whether spending should be cut, you know, big, steep spending cuts for people who need some of these programs. And it was very clear that voters did not favor that. But we have to remember why we have sequestration, right? It wasn't because everyone agreed that it was smart to cut $1.2 trillion across the board. It's because everyone agreed it was stupid, and it was supposed to force them to the negotiating table to do something real on the problem that Republicans put out that report today to force action on, which is the growth of entitlement programs, the growth of some of these government programs that everyone agrees, including the Obama administration, has said that they know that Medicare needs to be brought under control. They need to curb the growth of Medicare for the long-term good of the program, as well as to get a handle on the debt as a whole. What there has not been, even if you look at the polls, is enough public sort of urgency behind the idea of doing either one of the things that would be necessary to get a deal on this. That is, big cuts or big changes in the way that Medicare and Social Security work, or big significant action to curb loopholes and to really overhaul the tax code in a way that would produce more revenue, which paired with entitlement cuts could actually get you some of these long-term savings that they're talking about. So what you see now, the reason for putting that report out today, is kind of an opening bid's worth of arguments from both sides on why their way is the better way, why shrinking government is, in Republicans' view, the most important thing to do if we want to get the debt under control. And Democrats will come back and say, well, I'm sure we'll see reports. We've seen them in the past. I'm sure we'll see them in the coming weeks. Look how much you could do with the amount of revenue that is represented by some of these loopholes, some of these tax breaks that go to businesses and corporations and wealthy people who don't need them. Look what we could do. Look how much of a dent that could make in our problem. What hasn't been able to happen is to get a sort of a public push behind combining those two things to actually take some action on this. So while the debate was really joined in the 2012 elections, we didn't see a resolution, and that's what we're grappling with now. It's hard to get them from the crisis point that everyone acknowledges to some sort of solution.
And Julie Hirschfeld Davis, again, is congressional and politics reporter for Bloomberg News. And I heard a voice there. Was that you,
Mark?
Yeah,
no, it's Mark Sandler. I just wanted to jump in quickly on that report because I read about that report. And if it's the same one I saw, it's really a bogus set of numbers that are put out for propaganda reasons. As I understand it, what that report said was if you took all the money that's given to poverty programs and just divided among everyone who's under the poverty line, yeah, you get some like $70,000 per recipient, and we're obviously wasting the money. But the report didn't point out that a lot of the poverty money they're talking about goes to people above the poverty line. It goes to people who maybe are at 125% of the poverty line, or people living in households that are below the poverty line, but they're not. What that means is they were taking one number, which is all the money that goes out to a larger group of people, and then dividing it by a smaller group of people, which is extraordinarily dishonest. And what it does is it tries to make the argument that you can cut government and people won't feel it. And, you know, this touches on what Julie was just saying, that there are people out there who believe that there is a lot of waste going on, and to the extent that you think of government as a bunch of overpaid, lazy bureaucrats, and I don't doubt that there are some out there, if that's your view of government, $85 billion loss is no big deal. But when you start thinking of government as providing meals to senior citizens and, you know, early Head Start programs to kids and start taking away, it hurts. And that's sort of the nub of this fight, not only with the fight we're in the middle of right now, but with the debt ceiling limit fight from a couple of years ago, from the fiscal cliff a month ago, from the budget fight that's coming up at the end of this month. It's all about what you think the role of government is and whether or not you think this government right now simply wastes a lot of money or whether or not it's just expensive to run a country this rich.
And let me get to more of your calls here. George, join us. You're on. Hi.
Good morning. I think that all members of Congress should be patriotic now and step up to the plate and be part of the sequester themselves. I think that they should see a big cut in their staff budgets. I think congressmen can get their own coffee and make their own golf tee times. So I think we should furlough all their staff members one day per week because other people are going to be taking furloughs. Other government employees and defense contractor employees will be taking furloughs. And because the unemployed are going to be taking 11% haircut, I think the staff members of Congress should take 11% haircut on their expense accounts, pension benefits, and health care benefits.
All right, George, we thank you for that suggestion, and we'll leave it stand out there and go to another caller, and that's Joe, who's been waiting patiently. Joe, join us.
Hi, I kind of take issue with the term entitlement. We invest in these programs, and I doubt that any polling would suggest that people wouldn't be willing to pay a little bit more to keep these programs intact. And I think it's disingenuous of the Republicans to vote, potentially change the immigration policy and add 11 million people to Social Security and Medicare without somehow finding a way to pay for that. Thanks.
All right. We thank you for your comment. I want to get some more comments on here, hearing from listeners with a lot of opinions about what they've heard so far from our three guests, Mark Sandlow, Todd Zwillick, and Julie Hirschfeld-Davis. Matt writes on our website, so essentially what I'm hearing is that not ending the sequester could potentially be politically advantageous to either Democrats or Republicans, and as such there is less motivation to actually reach a deal, as one side is banking that holding out will harm the other. To me, this is a sad wake-up call on the across-the-board dysfunction in Washington. Another listener, Glenn, says, if we accept the premise that the Democratic Party is the pro-government party, then why can't the Democratic Party manage the size of government? Why can't Democrats be willing to reduce the size of even bad government? I believe it's because Democrats can't cut anything because this will show that government really isn't the cure for everything, thus removing the reason for their party existing. Why can't Democrats understand that government waste is really the real problem? And Beth writes, if I am fat and out of shape and I need to rethink how I live and make needed changes so I will become healthier and dependent on myself and not others, we as citizens need to start looking to ourselves and immediate family and even close friends when in need, not the government. Sadly, we have too many citizens and businesses that feed off the government teat, and it has to stop. We have more money going out than coming in, and even if we tax the rich folks 100%, we would still need to cut spending. Problem is, too many folks do not want the government to stop helping them. And Edward writes on our Facebook page, I'm a Department of Defense civilian employee in New York State. I live in a depressed area where job opportunities are scarce. This sequestration is going to hurt me and my fellow employees. We also have some of the highest taxes, too, so we get hurt twice. A listener emails us, Obama was trying to say, I'm not Superman. What he meant to say was, by law, this is not nor can it be my job. Congress's job is to execute the direction the president sets. Hence, it is precisely the Congress upon whom blame should be placed. Just a few more of your comments. On the web, a listener writes, I'm glad the sequestration happened since it's the only way it's going to get done. My beef with this, however, is that entitlements continue to be brought up. Many of these entitlement programs have specific taxes collected for them and thus only need to be balanced with that tax which is collected. It should not be affected by general funding issues other than the money that was borrowed from those other taxes to fund wars. And a listener comments on our website, while the tax increases recently accepted by Republicans are paltry, I wonder why Democrats have not put forward even a dollar in cuts. Is our government run so efficiently that we cannot find it? And Richard says, John Boehner says no more new taxes. Didn't the House in January just allow the Bush administration temporary tax cuts to expire for those with incomes over $450,000? Let's call a spade a spade. Let me go to Peter. Peter, you're on.
Good morning. I think the biggest single issue we have at hand is so simple to fix, and that is the problem that we have career politicians that don't do the next right thing. In their second term, they're more worried about getting reelected than doing the next right thing. So term limits is all I have to say, and I'll take my comments offline. Thanks.
All right, and you've certainly heard that argument before, Mark Sandlow.
Well, I mean, look at Sacramento. If you think of Sacramento as a model of government efficiency because those representatives are in and out so fast that they can't look towards building up long-term fiefdoms, then perhaps you think it's a good idea. I think that most people look at this think the term limits tend to empower staff. They tend to lead to people don't have longevity, and that there really hasn't been that big a change in Sacramento except that Willie Brown doesn't hang out there anymore. And I just want to clear up, you hear so much information, and I certainly don't pretend that I get it right all the time, but I just want to point out a couple things. The caller who said that congressional staffs really ought to take a haircut, they are. 8.2%. I was just Googling it as he was calling. 8.2% will be their cut. There will be millions of dollars less. The members of Congress can't have their salaries lowered because the Constitution says you can't do that midterm. But yes, they may have to go out and fetch their own coffee. And somebody said they couldn't understand why Democrats won't put a penny of cuts on the table. They've agreed to $2 trillion in cuts in aggregate over the last couple of years. So, I mean, the cuts have been on the table. Democrats have indeed agreed to big cuts. And I do think it's important to keep in mind something Julie said, which is the sequester was never regarded as a compromise. It was regarded as something so horrible that neither side would do it. And I sort of liken it to like two kids fighting over toppings on pizza. One wants pepperoni, one wants sausage. They come up with this weird idea because they can't agree. Let's get anchovy if we can't agree because we both hate anchovy, and that will force us to negotiate. But the kids can't figure out how to split toppings on the pizza or do whatever. And now we've got the anchovy pizza on the way, and literally nobody is happy with it.
Yeah, just take off the toppings and you got everything solved. Actually, Mark, I wanted you to respond to a listener who wrote on our web that you made a good point, an interesting point about Nancy Pelosi's strengths, but he goes on to say, unfortunately, for those of us who were once centrist Democrats, the party has been pulled so far to the right that many of us have dissociated ourselves from it. Pelosi fought a tough battle, but truth is, we've lost because the Democrats now stand to the right of the Nixon administration.
Well, you remember, it was the Nixon administration that that created the EPA that the Republicans are now fighting against. Certainly you could make the argument that when you listen to the most liberal members of Congress right now say the only way to do this is by compromising, and what that means is we'll have two or three times as much spending cuts as we will tax increases. There are a lot of progressives out there who say, wait, that's not the progressives I knew from a generation ago. Or the Democrats, Senator Feinstein being one, who supports, the confirmation we talked about earlier of the guy who oversaw the was integral in the torture program of the Bush administration, now being nominated by a Democrat as head of the CIA, or for that matter, nominating a Republican former senator to head the Defense Department. There are an awful lot of progressives who aren't happy with this. And once again, this is precisely why compromise is so difficult, because if those progressives got their way, Democrats would probably have 120 members in the House of Representatives, and they simply wouldn't have the power at the bargaining table they have right now. You might have a President Romney right now if you had Democrats pushing those kind of progressive ideas. So there is certainly room in the middle, and as liberal as Nancy Pelosi is, the one thing she's always understood is, sort of the art of getting things done. She's a pragmatist, and she understands that her liberal roots have to give way if she's going to get a semblance of her agenda adopted.
And a quick question, as we're running short on time here, Julie Hirschfeld Davis from a listener wants to know, couldn't these problems in Congress be simply remedied by reform of the filibuster?
Were it only that simple? No, I don't think everything could be remedied by reform of the filibuster, but that in and of itself is a Herculean task. I mean, to get even Democrats who are in control of the Senate only marginally right now to agree to kind of the big changes that would need to happen would be a huge thing, because the Senate is structured such that, all 100 of those people jealously guard their ability to stop anything in its tracks if they have a problem with it, and to figure out some sort of procedural way that they can get what they want, or that they can block what they don't want. And I think that's a really tough sell. We see it at the beginning of every Congress, an effort to try and fix what's broken on Capitol Hill, and in particular in the Senate. And so far, there hasn't been the real push behind that would need to happen for us to see filibuster reform. They're going to have to keep on hashing it out.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Julie Hirschfeld Davis, congressional and politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Thanks also to Mark Sandlow, associate academic director of the University of California's Washington Center, and Todd Zwillick, who is Washington correspondent with The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC. We thank all of you, and we thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated. Lawrence Wright is going to join us ahead to talk about Scientology and Oriana Fallaci. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai. Senior editor Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.